Good morning. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Hannah Colton, a public health reporter and KUNM news director. Thanks for tuning in this morning. The struggle for equity in New Mexico schools is ongoing. A judge next week could decide whether the state will stay under court order to address racial and socioeconomic disparities. Some programs meant to serve marginalized students like bilingual and special ed had their budgets cut in this week's emergency legislative session. We'll hear about those items. And teachers, parents, and students face tough questions about what classes will look like as the pandemic stretches into the fall. Tough road ahead. This morning, we're talking K-12 education. We want to hear from you. What systemic changes do you want to see in public education? Are state and local leaders doing enough to respond to calls to end institutional racism and other disparities? Give us a call this morning, 277-5866. I want to welcome to the program Sean Griswold, urban Indigenous reporter with NM In Depth, and also part of the Report for America program. Good morning, Sean. Thanks for taking the time.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So I want to talk about the Yazzie Martinez case. In July 2018, almost 2 years ago now, a judge found the state had violated the constitutional rights of Native American students, bilingual students, English learners, students with disabilities, and students from low-income backgrounds by failing to provide a sufficient education. We've been talking about this for 2 years now. And this March, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham asked that case be dismissed. From your reporting, what's the governor's reasoning behind wanting to end the court's involvement?
So the governor has been pretty clear about wanting to be able to basically argue that the state doesn't need any accountability from the court to or oversight from the court to run its education program. So that's the main argument for the state to dismiss Yazzie Martinez, is that the governor wants to be able to direct her education initiatives through the public education department without any court oversight. And we'll see this upcoming week, you know, the arguments that will also be made for why the state of New Mexico feels it no longer needs that court oversight.
And you published an article recently asking whether the push for education equity is at risk amid COVID-19 economic fallout. Can you talk to us about how that played out in this emergency session that just ended? Which equity-related school programs took a hit?
Yeah, so equity-related programs, such as an Indigenous multilingual, multicultural, and special education initiative, like every other program in the state, took a hit. So, you know, the revised bill was, they cut $700 million in spending from the largest budget that they passed in January. And so every department took a hit. Every program took a hit. Specifically, though, to these education initiatives, there was expected spending from the original budget passed in January for the program I just discussed on Indigenous and multilingual, multicultural, and special education initiatives. They were expecting to receive $5.5 million in additional new spending that would elevate these programs to continue going forward. With the new budget, those programs were cut nearly in half to $2.8 million. And this is going to be work that could provide linguistically diverse instructional material, like dual language program materials, whether in traditional native languages or even in Spanish language as well, too. And so those were cut. There was also a cut to the K-5 Plus program, which is an extended learning program that also served these students. Now, when I say cut, it's really important to understand that it was likely rolled over into the next year because there was no summer school initiative program,
right,
because of the public health order and COVID-19. There's still an effort by the state to continue the K-5 Plus program in the next summer, but to extend learning. And there was also some funding that's going to allow for schools to remain open for an additional days in this upcoming school year to provide that extra learning instruction for students who, as we saw in the spring, could be anywhere from 3 months to 6 months behind as they go back to school in August.
That's what studies from this spring semester showed about that loss of instructional time.
Loss of instructional time was huge for that. The very first information we received was from the Legislative Finance Committee when they were discussing budget proposals for the solvency bill that was just passed. And one thing that they noticed in their research was that one in five students during the spring semester who are doing social distance learning never checked in. So, yeah, 20% of New Mexico students are not checking in to their online instruction in the spring. And out of those that did check in, by the end of instruction time period, so by the end of the school year, only half of those students were completely engaged in their curriculum. So there's a bunch of factors in play as to why students weren't participating. The biggest issue is technology and the lack of technology for students. A lot of people talk about the digital divide, right. and it's real. We saw it during the spring semester. The main factors for that are internet access and then devices that can connect you to the internet. I was talking to students and parents who were having to drive to a McDonald's to access Wi-Fi, and then they'd have to use a cell phone to be able to access curriculum, either assignments or even do the assignments on a phone. I talked to a senior who actually wrote one of their final papers on a cell phone in a parking lot at their school just to grant Wi-Fi access. So, and these are the people who wanted to continue learning instruction and who even had the availability to get a ride. You know, most students don't drive. So it takes a huge family effort for a family member to drive a student to a Wi-Fi hotspot and then spend the time at that Wi-Fi hotspot for the instructional time that they otherwise would have been in school. So technology issues are a huge, huge issue for that. And then plus the overall, the general sense of what was going on during COVID-19 and the uncertainties and this new learning environment that teachers and parents had to jump into for the very first time. So there's a lot of lessons that we saw in the spring semester, and as schools start to open up in August where they're going to do a blended learning environment where students are going to have in-class instruction time and online instruction time, there's a lot of lessons that were learned in the spring, and hopefully the districts will be prepared to be able to provide that adequate learning environment.
Yeah, a lot of uncertainties. Thanks for that, Sean. And I want to welcome also to the program Jasmine Yeba. She is a policy analyst with the Native American Budget and Policy Institute and a tribal member of the Pueblo of Jemez. Good morning, Jasmine.
Good morning, Hannah.
Thank you so much for being with us. And so speaking about the Yazzie Martinez ruling and the governor's request that case be dismissed, why do you think it's important that that ruling stay in place right now?
Right. So there are many reasons that come to mind why the court should maintain jurisdiction over the case. But what we at the Native American Budget and Policy Institute have kind of boiled down to is funding and accountability. Mm-hmm. So, for example, complete implementation of the Indian Education Act is what the judge had talked about in the decision in order. What constitutes a sufficient education for Native American students is a complete implementation of the Indian Education Act. And so in 2019, we saw House Bill 250, the Native American Student Needs Assessment, which was passed. That was an amendment to the Indian Education Act. Although we have that change, and it was a very important step in the right direction to have this needs assessment for Native American students that every school mm-hmm. and district would complete, we still, schools have not seen any meaningful guidance from the public education department on how to actually implement that student needs assessment for Native students. So there's that example. Then we also have the example of not having an assistant secretary of Indian education for over a year now. That is a key leadership position for Native American communities for the PED to competently implement the Indian Education Act. It seems very doubtful that an agency would be able to meet the needs of such a robust act as the Indian Education Act without that type of leadership in place at the agency level.
And has there been any explanation from the governor's office about why she has not appointed someone to that position yet?
Yeah, so we have had discussions with folks from the PED, and it sounds like they have been very sincerely trying to look for a person to fill that role. Tribal communities have given input. Tribal leadership has given input on, and recommendations, actually names have been given, who, you know, the tribal communities have complete faith in, but for whatever reason or not, that position still just hasn't been filled. So it to see the motion be filed in the midst of, you know, such a complicated situation like this, and not having true leadership really at the PED level, it's very concerning as a Native American person and an advocate for education.
Yeah. Well, and so we've been talking about the public education department announced this week, you know, schools will reopen at 50% capacity with a mix of in-person and remote learning. Can you tell us about some of the specific challenges that you are seeing and talking about there in your community as that students are facing going into the fall?
Definitely. So this connects to what Sean had mentioned about internet access. In reading through the reentry guidelines that PED had put out, you know, as Sean had mentioned, schools will be going into a hybrid model where students will be expected to attend classes, if possible, on campus and then remotely from home. And it's very doubtful in my mind that especially Native students would be able to have meaningful remote learning when many of our students don't have technology devices, internet devices such as laptops or tablets, to be able to connect to internet. And then, of course, many tribal communities are not equipped with high-speed internet, thus not being able, those students not being able to access online classes. And so my daughter was an example of going through that. We had to go through that this spring semester as a parent of a kindergartner. And I had to step in, her dad had to step in as a teacher, and it was very difficult. So that is very worrying to me as an advocate for tribal education. And then, like I mentioned, I had to step in the role as a teacher. So many households in our tribal communities are multi-generational, with several children in the home of various ages. Mm. Those households would need the most support in assisting their students with finishing schoolwork and genuine knowledge building during remote learning. So in this instance, schools will need and should partner with tribal resources like tribal education departments as much as possible to assist families with remote learning, you know, especially if they don't have a laptop or a tablet to attend online classes, like I had mentioned, and especially when students are going to have to rely on mom, dad, or even grandma and grandpa to teach the curriculum. So those are a couple. I have a few more. You know, there is a lack of infrastructure on some and most tribal lands, I would say, which would make it difficult to find alternative learning spaces, which is what the PED guidelines recommend, that in order to keep social distancing measures in place, some students and teachers would have to go off campus, right, to teach classes in an alternative learning space. Well, that is going to be very hard for students and teachers that are based on tribal lands. Like here in Jemez, we have two schools that are in that category. And so when we don't have when we have a lack of infrastructure, that is going to be a pretty difficult challenge for teachers and students.
Jasmine, I'm going to pause you there. This morning, we're talking about K-12 education and how the pandemic threatens progress on addressing institutional inequities in the state schools. We have to go to a quick break. Remember, our phone lines are open. 277-5866 is the number to call. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Hannah Colton. We'll be back in a minute.
The Rothstein Donatelli Law Firm is committed to supporting KUNM, where the law firm's criminal practice can help clients petition state courts to permanently remove public records related to criminal charges and certain convictions. RothsteinLaw.com.
Support provided by Weekly Alibi, covering news, arts, and entertainment for Albuquerque since 1992. The friends at Weekly Alibi invite the community to help support local independent journalism when it's needed the most. Info at alibi.com/friends.
June is Black Music Month. We're celebrating the contributions of Black musicians past and present. Coming up, how Adrian Dunn blends spirituals with new compositions to explore the Black experience today. Music and stories for Black Music Month on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 FM KUNM. I'm Hannah Colton. We're talking about schools and systemic inequities in a COVID world. What changes do you want to see in schools? Give us a call, 277-5866. We're also on Twitter. You can use the hashtag Let's Talk NM. And Jasmine Yepa is on the line, policy analyst with the Native American Budget and Policy Institute. And I wanted to hear just a little bit more from you, Jasmine, about the schools there in the Pueblo of Jemez, because you'd mentioned to me that, you know, the charter schools there that have some really great programs that are, you know, culturally responsive and providing this sort of holistic community-based programs are also facing challenges when it comes to the pandemic because of community involvement. Can you talk to us about that?
Yes, sure. So, first of all, culture and language is everything to us as Native people, because without our culture and without a sustained language, we cease to truly exist as Native American people, right? So Native kids have a constitutional right to receive culturally relevant curriculum and instructional materials. And so the only way schools can receive those materials is by creating meaningful and collaborative relationships with tribal governments and tribal communities, as well as creating long-term and sustainable investments into tribal education departments. So that's like a lot to unpack, right? Mm-hmm. So basically what I'm saying is that schools, if they're going to implement culturally and linguistically relevant curriculum for Native students, a connection and collaborative relationship has to be made with tribal communities. That means bringing in folks from the community, meaning like elders who have certain roles that they play in our culture, bringing in family members to explain, you know, different roles that family members play in a Native American child's lifespan. And the list goes on. And so bringing the community is going to be very difficult during COVID remote learning because, you know, we're going to be having to take in consideration how close-knit and how small a lot of our tribal communities are. For schools that are located on tribal lands or near tribal lands, it's almost going to be impossible to have that kind of learning because schools and teachers are going to be on such high alert of basically keeping exposure to folks other than the teacher at a very minimum. So that seems very problematic to me that, you know, a lot of students are going to have to rely on their family. And that will be hard for students who have family members who have to work, who have to leave the home during COVID. And the students are having to learn, you know, in other ways. So that seems, it seems problematic in a way that will be lacking for some Native American students.
Yeah. And last question for you, Jasmine. Can you share anything about the conversations that you're having within your family and with your kids about what it's going to look like this fall? I mean, are you fielding a bunch of questions? Are you considering like a range of scenarios as far as keeping them safe, but also keeping them learning?
Yes. So in reviewing the reentry guideline document, I just had so many scenarios pop into my head because I have a six-year-old who is supposed to be entering first grade this year. And even just getting her to keep a mask on correctly for more than an hour even is difficult for me as a parent. And so it worries me that, will she be able to keep a mask on for several hours, even if it's just 4 hours or 3 hours right. during the day? It seems like that would be a difficult thing to expect from such young children. And we see that from the PED guidelines that K through third grade, kindergarten through third grade, would be the grades that would be most eligible, I guess, to receive in-classroom instruction. And so she would be in that group. Mm-hmm. So I think just teaching her that, it's important to wear a mask, teaching her to keep that 6 feet. Like, if anything, we'll have to practice what does 6 feet apart look like. And right. so I just foresee with small children, it's going to be a very difficult situation. And I commend all of the teachers, that are going to be going through that.
Thanks for that. And Sean Griswold, also on the line, urban indigenous reporter with NM In Depth and also affiliated with Report for America. Last question for you. What are you looking out for with this this hearing next week on the Yazzie Martinez case? And what are you going to be keeping an eye on when it comes to the budget next legislative session?
The case next week or the hearing next week, I'm most curious to understand what, if any, initiatives the governor will lay out in terms of a framework for how she would take over the measures that Yazzie Martinez lays out. That's ultimately what I want to know. I think that if you're mm-hmm. going to dismiss a case like Yazzie Martinez, you should be coming in with a plan because you're going to be having to start at step one. So that'll be very interesting to see if any, if that is part of the state's arguments for dismissing the case is we have this plan, we have this framework, this is what we prefer to use. Mm. And anything else that may come out of that to justify why they feel that the court doesn't need to give them oversight. So we'll be paying attention to that next week. And then anything going forward is, that's a big question, especially because this budget is, it's done a lot to support the state and keep the state going. The whole concern in the conversation in this budget conversation was looking over at January's budget and what the budget process is going to look like then. The state of New Mexico needs to figure out ways to increase revenue. And so in January, we could be seeing even further cuts to education initiatives if there's no new revenue for the state of New Mexico. Or the state's going to have to figure out ways to prioritize what is essential for the state. And there could be a lot more tough decisions and even tougher cuts that are going to happen in January. Between now and then, I'm really going to be following a lot of what Jasmine mentioned in terms of the accountability of what's going to happen with this reentry plan, how school districts have properly used or how school districts have used their CARES Act money, whether they're spending it on technology or PPE related costs. Is it going to do to the benefit of the student to have a greater education setting plus a safe setting? So there's a lot that's going to happen over the next 6 months. To determine really what the education outlook is going to look like for the next year going forward. Now, of course, we could also see another wave, which is something that predictive models have shown.
Right.
So if that were to happen, we could be even back at step one to what we saw with the education settings last spring.
Thanks for that, Sean Griswold. Tough times ahead. I just really keep saying that lately. It's kind of like, it's just a hard time. I want to welcome to the program Dr. Veronica Garcia, Superintendent of Santa Fe Public Schools. Good morning. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Hello.
Hi. So what is your budget outlook coming out of this special session? And particularly, can you talk to us about programs for those at-risk students?
Yes. Well, I want to piggyback on what was just said.
there's several concerns about, you know, how all of this is going to affect our budgets and long term. So let me just first start with what happened at the session, like House Memorial 1. You know, we were talking about, you know, the Yazzie Martinez case being appealed, you know, by the state wanting it dismissed. We cannot afford to have it dismissed. We need to have that the courts continue to monitor for all the reasons that your previous speakers just, you know, shared, right? It is critical that the courts keep their eye on it, because we saw cuts in our budget this, you know, going into next year from the special session. And one real important one was a $44 million credit against the CARES Act. And for the very reasons that your previous
speaker federal,
said.
That's that federal emergency money.
Yes, and it was intended for local districts to be able to address the needs of our children and, you know, our staff to keep our kids safe, right? And the extra expenses that we're going to have to address, you know, more sanitization, PPE, additional staffing that's going to be required with these new schedules and whatnot. And that money was distributed like Title I dollars, you know, in terms of the number of low-income students that you have that qualify for free and reduced lunch. So I think it was really, you know, not well thought out to take credit for that, for, you know, a portion of that money for Santa Fe Public Schools. It will mean a million less dollars that I'm going to have to now cut from my regular budget, because I took a credit and basically cut it from your regular budget. And so supplanted, right, with those dollars that were intended. And again, COVID-19, the pandemic, has really, you know, shown a light on the disparities of poor children and children of color. And, you know, New Mexico, we're still ranking 50th in child well-being. And we know that our Native American children are really suffering, as are all children. But in particular, certain parts of our state, you know, access to the internet, access to running water, you know, a lot of issues that, you know, poverty that are impacting our children to be able to benefit, right, even from a remote learning program. So it requires this additional support, and it's a real shame that that credit was taken. And I really urge the governor to you know, line item veto that language.
I'm going to pause you there. I'm going to take a call from Ellen in Albuquerque. Good morning, Ellen. What did you want to add?
Yeah, good morning. Actually, I'm going to kind of piggyback off of what she said. That also falls in line with the disabled community, as children with disabilities, because we have a, here in Albuquerque, we have a preschool with, you know, four.
I think we lost you, Ellen. But I did hear Ellen having a question about what's going to be done for students with disabilities, for special education students. Dr. Garcia, would you speak to that, about what you're planning with this sort of hybrid learning model for students with disabilities?
Yes. Yeah, so the guide, right now we are finishing up our survey that is very in-depth, so that we can capture, for example, children with disabilities who are in particularly medically fragile or in self-contained classes, but all children that are in special education, what model do the parents prefer? You know, the guidance says, you know, for particularly children that are in these self-contained programs, they should be brought back to school, right, in a 5-to-1 ratio. But I need to know, are parents going to be comfortable with that? We also are reaching out in particular to children who live on tribal land, because there may be, you know, very distinct reasons why they may not want their children to come to school. And how are we going to support them? You know, because if children contract it and say they're asymptomatic, it can be devastating, particularly to some of our smaller, you know, pueblos. So we are trying to reach out to all of our special populations in our survey to find out their unique needs. But it takes resources. And when we see cuts to our budget, you know, they call it a shave, which is a nice way, or sanding, rather. They call it sanding, which is a nice way of saying it was a cut. You know, it was a 1% sanding, so that was another 1% cut. And 1% doesn't sound like a lot, but for Santa Fe Public Schools, that was another $1 million.
Mm.
And, you know, and so that will impact our ability to do everything that we can for our students. We weren't sufficiently funded to begin with, which is why we have this lawsuit, right? And so House Memorial 1, it was very sad that it was not heard, but that would have sent a strong message to the executive to not appeal this case. It is critical that the courts keep their eye on it because our children will suffer. We need to give all of our students an equitable opportunity to be successful. And we haven't done that. And the pandemic has just made it worse. It has really shown those disparities in terms of families that don't have access, say, to the internet, or that their parents are essential workers. And so we had many kids who were at home with siblings, right, or with childcare providers that may be babysitters, right, but not necessarily in a childcare center because many of them were closed, or with older siblings were just alone. And that is very concerning to us.
Absolutely. Got a couple more callers. Let's go to Christopher in Albuquerque. Good morning. You're on air, Christopher.
Hey, good morning, Hannah. And thank you, Hannah and KUNM, for having the speakers raising such important issues. I just wanted to add that one of the things that I've seen as the executive director of Together for Brothers is how important it is to engage not only parents, but the students themselves. Often students aren't being asked about their perspective and feedback. And we see that not only with the opening of schools, but as many of the other guests are mentioning, COVID has shined a light on what the inequity that we've seen, like the Yasmin Martinez case also highlights, in our New Mexico schools. And I want to just bring up this idea of engaging students, especially students that are most impacted, like in Albuquerque, our urban native students and English language learners. And we see that connection to the school-to-prison pipeline. And so I just wanted to also make the connection that I think as we have the conversations about defunding the police and thinking about how to allocate more resources to not only the education system, but the systems like the out-of-school time systems that support students and families. It's how to also, and I really appreciate Dr. Garcia mentioning this idea that it's not just the teaching in the classroom, but it's engaging in families and the resources that school districts put to like community schools and social workers and other folks that engage students and families to be able to be in the classroom or to be in a virtual space. So engaging students and then just rethinking the resources, especially as a state, we have resources that we put into juvenile justice and then into the prison industrial complex. And we need to shift those resources to education and out of school time. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Christopher. Now I want to go to Cass calling from Taos. Good morning, Cass.
Hey, Hannah.
You're on the air.
Hey. So sort of a heavy act to follow talking about inequities and lack of funding and whatnot, but I have a potential bright spot, at least from my perspective as an outdoor and informal educator. I've sort of seen the reopening of schools as potentially a golden opportunity for this reframing of, instead of thinking about schools as sort of these institutions where kids sit in classrooms where they could potentially share germs and, you know, get contaminated with the virus, there's such an amazing abundance of informal education resources and nonprofits and organizations around the whole state that can offer social emotional learning, physical education, outdoor education, and these really interdisciplinary avenues for learning. And I do recognize that with those opportunities, there are similar issues in funding and inequities. But I think a lot of those organizations do what they can to kind of minimize those sort of issues. And I'm filled with this hope that if administrators kind of feel at a loss of like, how do I open schools with all these new changes? Like, there are ways out there that are existing that take kids outdoors, which is proven to be safer. A study came out in Japan saying that you're 19 times less likely to get the virus or something if you're outdoors. I'm working at a program currently that is taking kids outdoors in groups of five and without masks when we're, you know, spaced 6 feet apart on trail. And the positive benefits that I'm seeing in the kids from having connections with each other and connections with nature, I think is sort of a remedy for this sort of glum distance learning online kind of burden that's happening. So I encourage administrators and informal educators and people to converse with each other, because I think really wonderful things could come out of this.
Thank you for that, Cass. That's an interesting set of ideas. Thanks. We do need to go to a break. We're talking K-12 education this morning. The number to call, 277-5866. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. We'll be back in a minute.
Support comes from Instituto Cervantes, offering a fun and creative online Spanish language summer camp for children 6 to 12 years old, starting July 6th through the 24th. Complete details at 724-4777. Support comes from Positive Energy Solar, a local employee-owned benefits corporation installing solar electric systems in neighborhoods across New Mexico since 1997. Info on solar for homes and businesses at positiveenergysolar.com.
In Native America, elders hold a very important place. With the COVID-19 pandemic still in full swing, experts say elders remain at higher risk from the virus. On the next Native America Calling, we'll talk with elders about what they are facing right now and what wisdom they have to share during these challenging times. We hope you'll make plans to join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. I'm your host, Hannah Colton. And I want to welcome to the show two members of Families United for Education, or FUE, an advocacy group here in Albuquerque. On the line is Verland Coker and APS educator Aide Gonzalez. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being on. So your group published an open letter this month to Albuquerque Public Schools asking for a lot of specific steps for them to address systemic racism. And one of the things you wrote about was a statement the district released earlier this month in response to the killing of George Floyd and sort of making a Black Lives Matter statement. And what can you talk about what felt disingenuous to you about that statement on the district's part? Aide?
Yes. So Families United for Education has been trying to get APS attention for many years, regarding institutional racism, and we have not heard from them until recently. It's just, in the past 12 years, Families United for Education has been trying to point this problem in education. And it's just recently they released a statement saying that, yes, we do support all this without actually seeing or reflecting on their own practices.
And what are those practices that you've been trying to get APS to change or add or acknowledge?
Verland, go ahead.
Verland?
Okay. Well, most of what we want from them is anti-racism training and better restorative justice training and implementation district-wide. One thing that we've noticed from APS is that we usually get a lot of half measures in terms of not only implementation, but of quality for these practices. To no fault of the rank and file employees who advocate for these. It's mainly been an administrative issue as well as a district-wide sort of commitment issue. And so when APS comes out with statements, again, recommitting the same commitments we've seen and try to act on for the past 15 years, it's been very frustrating and quite frankly insulting to see that they're almost co-opting a movement to try to make it seem like APS has been good on these issues when statistically speaking they haven't.
And the data that you reference in the letter shows that African-American and Hispanic students are disproportionately disciplined with suspensions in APS. And you're sort of calling the school board out for failing to acknowledge those racial disparities. Can you talk about what happened and how you're trying to hold the district accountable on that discipline issue?
Sure. So what initially happened is that the suspension rates came out and were presented to the board. And at that time, a lot of the school board members were very concerned with these alarming statistics, and again made these commitments to try to change it. Something should be done, X, Y, and Z. But this was quite some time ago, and we had saw in an article that their communications had stated that in response to these statistics that suspensions are only based off of behavior, which just even from a baseline statistical analysis point, just it can't be true. And so we've asked them time and time again to correct this statement. We've asked, you know, that department specifically for communications, as well as the equity and engagement section of APS. And we're still trying to figure out how to get them to at least admit that that isn't true. And we've gone to school board meetings and we've contacted school board members. We've done everything that we could to try to hold them accountable to the statements and try to at least get some semblance of honesty in this discussion. And it just hasn't happened. And so now we've decided to craft an open letter and get this information out there and have students, families, and organizations sign on to it in order to make a statement to hopefully empower the school board as well as the district to make some definable changes. We've had these solutions for decades at this point, and we've just need the administration and the leadership to act on it.
What kind of response have you seen from the community to that open letter?
It's been fairly successful. At time of recording, we have about 140 signatures from individuals and families, and quite a few organizations, including, you know, Mexico Dream Team, some portions of the ACLU, Strong Families New Mexico, Southside Organizing Project. And we received very positive feedback. And the way we have it structured is that even if there's some things on our list of demands that you don't quite agree with, you can still sign on. And it's something that we need to have unity for, because we've seen these issues for decades and nothing's changed. Now is the time to act.
And where can people find that open letter?
We have it posted on our Facebook page. That's probably the easiest way to get a hold of it. As well, you can directly email Families United for Education at familiesunitedforeducation@gmail.com. Those are the two main avenues of contact as of right now.
Gotcha.
We do want to get our social media pages up and running, but that takes a little bit of effort.
Yeah. And I have a caller on the line from Albuquerque. Jean, good morning. You are on air. What did you want to add?
Good morning. Am
thanks
I
for
on
calling.
Air right now?
Yeah, thanks for calling. You're on air.
Hi. Well, my name is Jean Thoreau, and I was a teacher in Albuquerque for 30 years, and I taught students of all needs, and these issues have been my major concern for all of New Mexico and actually for all of the United States, in a way, how since we started in the 80s under Reagan, when they had the Carnegie Report and they graded teachers in the United States and they gave them a D, and suddenly this anger at teachers and education has just been systemic. But all we've done to address the problems is give these humongous tests that just basically end up failing so many of our kids, and then they fail our schools, and they tell the teachers that they're bad teachers, and they tell the students that they're bad students, and then we wonder why they drop out. But when we label our minority students and any slower students as if they're failures, they're stupid, they're lazy, they're thugs, that makes those students and their families become dehumanized, afraid, and sad. And we are failing our poor minority students. Only 67.9 students graduated in 2017, and that number is probably stacked because New Mexico has traditionally tried to stack their number along with Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama and South Carolina because our numbers are so low. Well, some of the reasons that our numbers are low is because we have a lot more kids that come from disadvantaged homes. A lot of the kids have physical or psychological disabilities. They live in poverty or in abusive situations. They have well below an average IQ. 30% or more of our kids speak English as a second language. We have a large population of kids that are homeless or live in substandard homes.
And Jean, let me ask you, what do you think the school system needs to do to better serve these students? I mean, I think the disparities are well established, yeah.
Well, I think one of the things that happens right now is that the standardization and the standardization that kids are tested on is if you have a kid that is in fourth grade and they're not reading on grade level, their curriculum, teachers do not have time. At one point, I remember when Superintendent Harold Brooks in Albuquerque said that every kid needs to be on the same page on the same day, which leaves no time for teachers to retest. So if you have kids that are reading at a first grade level in a fifth grade class, and your material that you're teaching is all at that same level, but you have kids that can't read that material, you need to be able to go back and reteach them, and you need to have time to teach those kids so that you can use all the different learning modalities. But the system as it is, it just is like, we want to push kids through the material, and then if the kids fail, we're just going to keep passing them on, but we're not going to
give. Thank you so much, Jean. Yeah, I'm hearing that need for more flexibility and more and different ways of learning. I want to go back to two members of Families United for Education. Aide Gonzalez on the line. What are some other concrete steps you want to see APS take to really address these structural issues that we've been talking about?
Well, we want anti-racism staff training for everybody, and we want a mandatory mediation and de-escalation staff training. I think that we also need high-quality bilingual programs and ESL instruction because, you know, if there is research that it says that if students do not develop their first language, mm-hmm. then they can now learn a second language. And if this push for English-only idea, we have seen it for a long time, and I think it's time for, you know, for see a push on that, too. We want invest in technology and digital literacy, we want reinvest in restorative justice.
Mm-hmm. And that would address the disparities in the disciplinary system that y'all were talking about, restorative justice. And what would that look like? Like, how would that change the interactions between students and teachers?
I think that, having mediation and de-escalation training will make teachers understand and respond in a better way instead of calling the police, immediately. And also, like, anti-racism trainings will make us understand where everybody's coming from and see your own bias. Mm-hmm. Restorative justice practices, I think it's a way for us to heal and to move forward with a better way, you know, to respond for misbehavior, if you wanna see it like that.
And the search for a new APS superintendent is underway. Verland, what would good leadership look like to you? What do you want to see in that hire?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion for the new superintendent. There's even an idea circling around that maybe we should restart the search to find leaders that would, you know, to take in consideration the pandemic, which is something that I disagree with, merely because one thing that we really need right now is someone who understands that the issues that we're running into in the pandemic were issues that we've always had. We've always had an issue with technology integration. We've always had an issue with how distance learning is done. We've had an issue with equity and providing resources to our teachers. And these are things that have always existed that are amplified by this pandemic. Combine that with the growing need to address systemic racism. We need somebody who has the agility and, quite frankly, humility to address these issues. We oftentimes, especially now, try to position ourselves, at least from a leadership perspective, as we're doing the best that we can when we need to do so much better. We are last in education, we're last in child well-being. Now's not the time for pride. Now's the time to actually address these issues that we have to accept our shortcoming and be able to move forward. This is something that we just have such struggle doing here because it means that everyone's at fault. And so a new superintendent isn't necessarily going to be able to fix everything because it's so deeply ingrained. But we need someone who is receptive mainly to the community and especially to those that we leave behind. We're talking, you know, high school dropouts, students that are in the school-to-prison pipeline. These are the voices that we need to be uplifting and that need to get to leadership because they're the ones who are most privy to the failings of the system. And so at least from my perspective, as well as a lot of others, that's what we need. We need leadership that is open, willing to communicate and take and act on criticism.
Thank you for that. We are out of time for the hour. It always goes too fast. A big thank you to all of our guests, Jasmine Yepa, Sean Griswold, Veronica Garcia, Aidea Gonzalez, and Verlin Coker. And thank you to everyone who called in and sent questions and comments. The conversation doesn't have to end here. You can comment on our Facebook page. If you're on Twitter, use the hashtag #LetsTalkNM or email us at letstalk@kunm.org. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen back on kunm.org or subscribe to Let's Talk New Mexico on your podcast app of choice. Support for our public health coverage comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation and from listeners like you. A huge thank you to our team this morning. Engineer Marino Spencer on the board, Kaveh Movahed screening your calls, Taylor Velasquez on Twitter, and Yasmin Khan in the producer's chair. The executive producer is me. I'm Hannah Colton. And thanks again for listening to Let's Talk New Mexico here on KUNM.